Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember, to talk to Kevin, press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your call. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Lisa is screening your calls. We'll be here for the next hour, taking your calls and answering your questions. If you're listening online and you'd like to join us live on the call itself, pick up the phone and dial 347-884-8327. Once you're on that call, you can sit and just listen along if you'd like, or if you've got a question, a comment, a topic, whatever it might be, press 1 on your phone, and you can do that right now. Any time during the call, press 1 on your phone. You'll talk to Lisa first, and then I will get to those calls here in just a little bit. The number again, 347-884-8327 to join us on the call. I'm going to get to a couple things. I'm going to go through the rates and the load indexes and what's going on there. A couple things I want to talk a little bit about what I call fuel hedging services, and I'll explain what that is. And the reason I'm bringing it up, I've been getting more and more emails, people asking me questions about whether these are a good idea, and I guess they were talking about them on another show. So I will get to some ideas and maybe have some answers for you on what those services are all about as well. The load index is down again this week, kind of expected. This is for the week of May 16th to the 22nd. Now, I do expect we might see the index go back up next week. We'll see. We've been down about 2 weeks now, which is what we expected, middle of the month kind of stuff, beginning and middle. We're hoping, and if trends hold, we should see the end of the month pick up a little bit, and then June being the end of the quarter, we should see that pick up as well. Should carry us into the summer pretty well. Even though we're down on the week, we're still doing really well for the month and certainly doing well for the year. Just some numbers here. The overall load index is down 5.2% on the week. The truck index is up about 0.5%. So there's 0.5% more trucks being posted into the market. Not a big change there. That's virtually flat. If we look at the individual segments, dry van load to truck is down 4.3%. Flatbed load to truck down 6.1%. Reefer load to truck down 0.2%, which is virtually static, not doing anything. Fuel prices are down for the week. That's a bad thing in my book. Let's look at some of the individual indexes and what's going on there. If we look at the dry van load to truck ratio right now, last week it was 3.21, meaning there were 3.21 loads for every truck, for every one truck posted on the board. This week it's 3.07. So even though we're a little down, we're still talking 3-to-1 loads to truck. So for every one truck dry van that's posted on the boards, we've got 3 loads being posted. If we look at the reefer load to truck ratio, Last week it was 7.40. This week 7.38, virtually level. So for every one truck reefer posted on the boards, there are seven loads available. So right now, when I say it's down, it's kind of like a year ago when I said it was up a little bit. Being up a little bit really didn't change anything in the real world because it was so low. You know, a couple points up really didn't help anybody much. Same thing's happening now, just the opposite. We might have a down week here or there, but we're up high enough that a couple point drop, even, you know, several weeks in a row, really isn't going to matter in the real world. When you're looking at 7-to-1 loads, you're in pretty good negotiation power. 3-to-1, if you know it and you know how to negotiate, puts you in a much better position than we've been in a long time. And then just the absolute crazy segment, flatbed load-to-truck ratio right now, 32-to-1. Last week it was 34-to-1. So a two-point drop, fairly significant, but is it really going to matter to anybody? I mean, if you're running a flatbed now and you realize what's going on, does it matter that there's only 32 loads for every truck instead of 34? I still think you should be able to negotiate pretty darn good rates in the flatbed sector right now, and you should certainly be staying busy, if nothing else. Just to give you an idea of where we are on that, the flatbed load-to-truck ratio in April, if we compare it to April of 2009, it is 13 times higher. I went back through all the records I could ever find or seen anything quite like it. So still enjoying some pretty good load-to-truck ratios right now, and I think that there's a possibility we could see it go up a little bit next week. I'm not thinking a lot, but we might see some steady rises in all these numbers throughout June. June should be a pretty good month right up to the end, so we'll wait and see. If you have any questions about the index, by all means, give me a call. The number to join us here, 347-884-8327. We've got lines open. If you're on the call, go ahead and press 1. I see we've got two or three calls lined up. We'll be getting to those here in just a minute. I do have one more thing that I want to go over, and that is fuel hedging. I've been getting more and more questions about this. I've had several emails, and people are telling me they heard this on another show, and it sounds like a great thing. And they're not really calling it fuel hedging. What they're doing is they're hearing shows about specific websites, and then they're sending them to me. But this is similar to businesses that hedge fuel costs. Now, the most successful company out there at hedging fuel prices is Southwest Airlines. They do a fantastic job of it, and they stay very profitable. They've been doing it for years. Fuel hedging, what it means is that you try to predict which way fuel prices are going to go, and then you're able to lock in prices ahead of time and buy contracts. It's similar to speculating on oil. So you've heard that, you know, all this volatility in fuel prices is caused by speculators, and there are two different ways to speculate. You can speculate by buying contracts only and buying and selling the contracts, never taking control of the fuel. So pure speculators, they don't ever buy any fuel or oil or aviation fuel, jet fuel, diesel fuel. They don't buy the actual product. What they do is just try to bet on the price and buy and sell the contract at different prices. A lot of people believe that speculators are the problem in the oil price. I don't believe that it is that big of a deal. The other way to speculate is really more hedging, would be a better word, for people who will be ultimately buying the product. So, for instance, an airline like Southwest, who uses obviously a lot of jet fuel, they will hedge, not really speculate. When they hedge, what they're saying is they believe that in 6 months, the price of their jet fuel will be X. Whatever that number is, higher or lower than what it is today, and they will buy contracts to try to take advantage of that. Now, none of us have a crystal ball, and there is a ton of risk in trying to speculate or hedge, either one. There's a lot of risk, and Southwest is very good at it, but they have lots and lots of resources, people and departments that do nothing all day long but work on this one thing. And Southwest was so successful at it, and they got a lot of attention when, 2 years ago, when fuel prices went through the roof. They had locked in their price in the $2 range, and it went into the $4 range, and all the other airlines were absolutely getting killed, losing money. Southwest was still making money, a lot due to the fact that they had been hedging fuel prices for a long time, and they did a very good job of locking in low prices. So all the other airlines finally said, oh, boy, we better start hedging fuel. And they did. And they got killed because they hedged at the wrong time. And it's not like they were just guessing. They had huge departments and lots of people trying to predict what the prices were going to be. And they still screwed it up. This is a very tough thing to do. Now, big companies have been doing it for a long time. Sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. So that's fuel speculation and fuel hedging. Now, there are websites that are trying to take advantage of that concept and bring it to the individual. One of them that was brought to my attention that was on another show on Sirius, it's called moregallons.com. So I've been doing some research on these and looking at it from a pure numbers point of view, and I'm not impressed. In fact, before I even get into this, I'm going to tell you that my recommendation is to stay away from these kind of services. First of all, this isn't true hedging because you can only take advantage of price movements in one direction. You can only win if fuel goes up. True hedging, when you look at companies like Southwest who are really good at it, they are able to take advantage of prices moving in both directions. You can't do that with these services. Your only bet is that you're going to buy fuel at a price today, and then at some point, if it goes up, and if it goes up enough, then you can cash that back in, and you may, there's no guarantee just because it went up enough to make this worthwhile for you. If it goes down, your money's stuck there for who knows how long. Had you been hedging or using one of these services in 2008, you would still be sitting on your money waiting for the price to come back enough for you to make a little bit. So you've really got to be careful. Fuel prices are very volatile. We had a several weeks of run-up in prices, and it would have been very tempting 2 or 3 weeks ago, it would have been very tempting to lock in prices on a site like this. But guess what? They're on their way down now. Who knows where they're going to go? Will they go back down into the 270s or 280s? I don't know. Will they go up next week to 350? If we knew, we could be rich. But we don't know, so you've got to be very careful with this. And like I say, I think individuals should stay away from this. I can tell you, no matter how much research I do on this and no matter how many prices I watch and analysts I read, there is no way I would attempt to try to lock in fuel prices. I wouldn't do it. Now, here's another downside. When you look at this website, and I'm picking on one in particular here because I got an email about it, moregallons.com. I'm looking at the home page, and right top home page it says, here's your current fuel prices. Here's what you can buy fuel at. $2.47 a gallon for diesel. Well, holy cow, that sounds great because I track the diesel price, and the average price right now is $3.01 a gallon. I'm thinking, wow, $2.47, how can I possibly get it for that? Well, here's the thing you have to dig down into the research to find. First of all, there is a service charge when you buy and when you redeem, when you sell. I'm not going to get into all the details on how this works. They make it fairly simple. It's not that big of a deal. But you've got to figure in that service charge when you buy and when you sell. It's 6 cents a gallon both ways. I'm going to pay 6 cents a gallon above this price when I buy it. I'm going to pay 6 cents a gallon above this price when I sell it. So we need to add 12 to the 247 right off the bat. I'm looking at it. That still doesn't sound like a bad price. Sounds like a great price to buy fuel at. But there are zero taxes included in this price. No federal tax, no state tax, no local tax, no taxes whatsoever. So when you go back in and you add in all the taxes and the service charge to see how much we're really paying for this, what price we're able to lock in today, I did the math. If we lock in the price today after federal tax is added back in, we can't add state tax, remember, because every state is different. So what I did was I took the locked in price, which was $2.83 a gallon, and I compared that to all of the state prices with the state tax taken out, just like I do every day for fuel prices. And it would put that price at number 39, worst price in the country right now. So this is not cheap fuel. You're not locking in at a good price. And if the price goes down like it has about 6 days in a row now, now you're locked in at a price that's more expensive than the market. So all you can really do is sit on it and wait to see what happens. So if you've been enticed or interested in one of these pre-buying fuel hedging services, I say stay away from them. They're all going to be about the same when you work out all the numbers. All right. If you want to join us, there are some lines open, 347-884-8327. If you're listening online, pick up your phone, join us on the call. If you're on the call and you've got a question, it looks like I've got four to get to, maybe five. Just press one on your phone. Lisa will pick it up. She'll talk to you first, and then I'll start getting to those calls right now. I'm just going to work right down from the top here. Let's go to Wisconsin. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, hi, it's Art. Are you there?
Yep, go ahead.
Hey, I bought a Centric 2000. It's got 24.5s on it. How bad is it going to hurt me when I switch it, if I switch it over to 22.5s when I put new tires on it? It's got 13-speed in it, and it's supposedly 258 rears.
358.
I'm sorry.
Okay, 358. How fast do you like to drive?
65.
And what year is this truck?
1000.
Okay. You're going to be much better off. It's not going to hurt you at all. It's going to help you a lot to go to 22.5s, and I would go to low pro 22.5s. It'll actually put this truck right in the RPM range we'd like to have it at, 65.
That's what I like, the 22.5 low pros, but it had 24.5s on it too, so I only get 4,000 the truck, so it ain't break me of this money.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? You could easily go out and spend more on tires than you spent for the truck.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in a month, I'll have the money saved up to rebuild the motor if anything goes wrong with it. Supposedly has $1.2 million on it, but I knew the guy that I bought it off of. He had it for 5 years.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to go wrong when you can buy a truck at that price.
Yeah. Okay, that's pretty much all I had to ask you. I just wondered about the tires.
All right. Yeah, you will definitely be better off with low pro 22.5s. It's exactly what we would want on that truck. In fact, depending on what's on there as far as brand and style and that kind of thing, between the size change, and if you do go to a lower rolling resistance tire, you could easily pick up anywhere from 3 to 5 tenths just making that change. All right, let's see. Let's head off to Alabama this time. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ken. Kevin, I got a question about the accumulative effect of some of the changeovers. I'm about to drop my catalytic converter and put some flow-through pipes on.
Okay.
Now, I'm already on the light side. I'm very regularly getting 8.3 on my C15.
Wow.
And, I mean, let me tell you where my last jump is. For over 2 years, I got 7.5.
Okay.
And I heard you a couple of weeks talk about, you know, some shifting on the hill. I tried it on the heavy side. On the heavy side, actually, I lost some mileage. I mean, it's a little still inconclusive, but I've actually lost some mileage. But on the light side, I've tried to keep my boost below 15 pounds, and I've jumped a half to three-quarter of a mile a gallon.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a big jump.
It is a big jump.
And those are
and,
great.
Well, I run the same lane. I typically load myself light. I got a couple of regular parts runs I run that are light. And, you know, the flow-through is, you know, making some pretty strong claims. I've got a mortar. They're on their way for my 387. I'm going to drop the converter. It's got 850,000 miles on it, so just that alone,
yeah.
I anticipate seeing a change just in putting fresh stuff on, dropping the converter. I mean, catalytic converter.
Right.
But now, okay, I've got some air tabs coming. You know, talking with the guys over there, they, you know, mileage was actually the third thing that he spoke of as, you know, one was control, two was spray, and three was mileage.
I agree with that assessment. That's a good way to talk about that product. That makes sense.
Now, the third product, and I really don't know if I'm going to go for it, and I know you've spoken about it, and that is the Fleet Air filter. $300, it seems a little pricey for me. I watch my my flow intake. On a regular basis, I get no reading on mine at all. Its gauge does work, but I don't see restriction in my air. Now, go ahead.
Well, go ahead with your question.
Well, so cumulatively speaking, I mean, and I'm a skeptic. I mean, I wouldn't even have changed what I was doing if I didn't have 850,000 miles and I wanted to drop my converter. I don't even know if I would have changed anything.
Right, right.
But since, you know, I'm dropping the converter and it's got that many miles, all I can see is an up on that. But, you know, accumulatively speaking, if I did the flow through the air tab and the air filter, accumulatively speaking, you know, my numbers would be off the chart, but I don't think it's going to work. I don't think it'll be like that.
And you're right, and here's the way we have to look at this, because you're questioning this right. If you were talking to me saying you were getting 6 miles to the gallon and you wanted to do those three things, I would be very confident in saying that with those three things, you're going to pick up a half mile per gallon or more. I wouldn't hesitate to make that claim at all. I would be confident in it. But when you're at 8 miles to the gallon, or the high sevens, low eights, the kind of ranges you're talking about, I wouldn't even venture to put a number on it, because it gets tougher and tougher. I mean, I've got a truck
right.
that back up to that eight now, and it's going to get tougher as we go. But here's the other thing that I know, and this is the way I look at these things. First of all, if the product has other benefits, and, you know, everybody can claim lots of things. Everybody
right.
out there with a product claims a lot of things. But if I look at a product like AirTabs, which across the board, I just get good reviews back from people. And it's got other benefits. So it's a small investment. It seems like if we improve aerodynamics, just logically we know there has to be a fuel gain somewhere. Can
right.
we measure
right.
it? Maybe not in an operation like yours, but I've got the other benefits, so I'm in. Fleet air filters. There are some other benefits here. Can we measure the fuel savings in your operation? Maybe not. But we have the fact that it filters better. That's a good thing. Better than the paper filter. When you look at that restriction gauge,
yeah.
that restriction gauge is designed to measure when your paper filter starts to clog. And it takes quite a bit of restriction
yes,
just
does.
To move that thing at all.
Right. Right.
What we're looking for is a much more sensitive, you know, reading on airflow. We know, forget that gauge. We've put this thing on flow benches, and we know that as soon as we put this in, we get better flow. Paper filters are one-dimensional. As soon as they start to get dirt, which they actually need that dirt to be efficient to trap more dirt, as soon as that happens, we do have reduced airflow. Not enough to trip that gauge, but we've lost some airflow. So I like the fact that it filters better, and I'm getting more airflow, and it's a lifetime filter. I'm going to wash it, and I don't have to replace it again. So there are some other benefits, and logically we should pick up some fuel mileage. Those are the kind of products I'm looking for. The next one that, you know, we just did on my trucks, and I've actually got some numbers coming in, is the Evans coolant. Is there some fuel mileage improvements? We think so if you run the engine hotter and you keep the fan off. But are there other benefits? Absolutely. It's a lifetime coolant. I don't have to worry about my additives being depleted. The additives will last as long as the coolant lasts, which is lifetime. There's no pressure in the system. So now we have less chance of leaks and pressure-related problems. It protects better against cavitation. So it protects against hot spots, and it's more efficient. So that there are the other benefits, and again, it's not a very big investment. So I like it, and cumulatively, if we do these things and we start picking up maybe small amounts that we can't measure, we're still saving money. Another good example is, you know, Schneider testing these wheel deflectors, the wheel covers.
Yeah.
There is no way I'm ever going to be able to detect that change in my operation. Too many variables, not a big enough difference, but it's been proven to work. It's a small investment, so there's another one. And if we do all these things, that's how we consistently get those trucks that stay right up there at the top of that fuel mileage range.
Right. Well, if I can add something else here, you know, since February, we have seen some record profits on our side. We had a good year last year. We've got our fuel cost down right at 20%, actually 21.7.
Wow, that's outstanding.
And from February, our fuel cost has actually dropped below 18%, but mostly because our rate has, you know, we've been able to generate more revenue,
right,
running the same lane, and you know, on our P&L for last year, our profit was 47%.
That is fantastic. You know, the best trucking company out there, when I check numbers, and when you look at the really, really well-run companies, companies like Heartland come to mind. Maverick usually does really well. Knight, Mesilla Valley, the companies that we can get numbers for, the very best trucking companies are running operating ratios in the high 70s, you know, 77, 78% in good times, meaning that their net profit is in the 20s. So when you get into the 40s, that's just outstanding.
You know, I always felt, and this is exactly how I approach it. Very few are able to compete against me in what I do. That's exactly how I approach it. I have better controls. I have a better understanding of what I'm doing. I have better focus on niche. And when it comes to lower rates, I'm better off. And when it comes to the negotiating on the top side, I'm better off. I am better than my competition.
You know, when you do that, and that's what I always strive to try to achieve as well. You know, when we look at a time and an economy like we just went through, with high unemployment rates and the industry being decimated, you know, no matter how bad the economy gets, if you can put yourself in the top 10% of what you do, you'll never have anything to worry about. We will never get down to the point where the top 10% is going out of business.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, to answer your question, I think that, you know, yeah, I continue to do the things that make some sense. I'm not going to run out by every gadget that, well, I might just because I like testing this stuff. But I'm not going to put any faith in or recommend every gadget that comes along with every claim. But when I do the research and logically there are some benefits, when the physics seem to prove out the fact that there should be some benefits, I'll look at it. And then if we can do a little testing or if we can see somebody else's testing, you know, then I'll get interested. So all of the products I'm looking at right now, I'm interested in it, and the numbers are starting to work themselves out. The big exception, and I'm going to have to do an entire show, I think, on propane when we're done with the numbers. Propane is probably the most, not probably, it is the most complicated cost analysis as far as products go that I'll ever do. And when we're all done with the numbers, I will put together an entire show to try to outline all the factors involved. The one of the very big differences with a system like propane, comparing it against a lot of other things we talk about, most things we talk about have a one-time cost, and then we could eventually overcome that cost, break even, and see a return on investment. That may happen with propane. The problem is the cost is ongoing and changing all the time. So trying to nail down a return on investment is a little more complicated. Actually, it's a lot more complicated. All right, let's go to South Carolina this time. Billy, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening. My question is, the company I work for, you know, times are getting tighter and everything, and it's about accidental things happening to you, you know, like say you tear up a tire, you drive underneath something and tear your exhaust pipes off, you know, something to that effect. That's not the company's fault is what they said. It says, we didn't do that. It's not our fault. You're driving the truck.
Right.
You should have did this. You should have did that. We're not paying for that anymore. That's going to be on you. Well, I can understand their theory or logic in wanting to do that. Because they really didn't do it. I mean, you know, you're driving a truck. If you drove under something and tore your pipes off, well, hell, I guess that's your fault.
Right.
So they charge you for it if you don't quit them, and you stay there and you pay for it. Can you claim that like you would an unreimbursed company expense?
Yeah. You can, because it's a cost of employment for you. So as an employee, we are allowed to deduct business-related expenses that are unreimbursed. Now, this is obviously a business expense, because if you don't pay it, you're not going to have a job. I mean, that's just the, so. Yes, this is what would fall under an employee business-related expense, and because it wasn't reimbursed, you can claim it on your taxes. Obviously, keep all the receipts, that kind of thing. And, you know, when you say times are tough, they're actually getting much better in the industry. Maybe they'll turn around their policy on this. I realize, you know, over the last 2 years, companies were really digging deep to stay in business. Now, I've always had a different take on this when it comes to drivers, and I've employed drivers for 20-some years. Things happen, and yes, I know that sometimes it's the direct fault of the driver. I just went through this last week. I had a driver tear off a mirror. Now, a mirror doesn't sound like that big of a deal unless it's a Volvo, because it was $1,000 to replace a mirror, which
wow.
is just, yeah, not only that, it was $1,000 to replace the mirror, and we couldn't get the mirror in time. We ended up losing a day of work. So now we have the lost revenue. I could have gone and rented a truck, but I break even at best when I do that. And when one of my trucks breaks down and it's my fault, I absolutely go rent a truck. This was the driver's fault. I didn't charge him for the mirror. I'll eat the $1,000. I didn't run out to get a rental truck and go out of my way so that he could work that day, because all I do is break even. So I guess his punishment was he missed the day of work. My punishment was cost me $1,000. But I've always figured that I'll eat those costs. Now, if I get a driver who does that too often, I'm not going to charge him. He's just not going to work for me anymore.
There you go.
So, but to answer your question, yes, if you incur those charges and you have to pay them, they are deductible.
Okay, I got one more thing about the Pittsburgh Power muffler that the guy was talking about, the flow-through muffler.
Yeah.
I looked at that on a website today, because I was trying to, about maybe telling the boss, you know, to change the mufflers.
Right.
And I got a 387 Pete with the DPF. It's a 2010, and it says they're not desirable or something like that. I forget what the words were. It was in red, and it said they didn't work well with the DPF filter. Is that because they
won't
can't
work at all?
They don't take the heat as well or something? Or
no, they won't work at all. And the reason is because trucks with the DPF, they don't have a muffler. The DPF is the muffler, and you can't replace it because the electronics, the ECM, monitors pressure going into the DPF, monitors pressure coming out of the DPF, and if it doesn't get the exact readings it's supposed to get, it derates the engine because it assumes something is wrong. So you can't take the DPF out and put a muffler in, the engine derates and it just won't run.
Okay, what if you left the DPF in and just changed the mufflers off and put the...
There are no mufflers.
Well, what are those up the back of the truck?
Just they're just stacks. I mean, there are no mufflers, and the restriction in the system is created by the DPF. I mean, all of our restriction comes from the DPF. After that point, it doesn't matter what you put back there. Nothing's going to change what happens after the DPF. So, unfortunately, anything after 08, there's nothing we can do to improve exhaust flow. So, you know, when we talk about ported and jet hot coated manifolds, or possibly running a larger turbo housing or a flow through muffler, all of those things work because they improve exhaust flow and reduce back pressure. None of them will work on a truck after 08 because all of the back pressure in the system is created by the DPF, and there's nothing we can do to fix that. Let's go to Arkansas this time. Hugh, welcome to the program.
You use mirrors on those, pulling those pups?
Yeah, once in a while it's fun to look back and watch them wiggle all day.
Yeah, just something I was thinking about today. Go ahead.
I'm not sure why we need mirrors. We never really back up.
Right, that's what I was thinking, man. Just full speed ahead, and, you know, when you change lanes, just, you know, you figure everybody's looking out for you. You know?
Put on your turn signals, blow the horn a couple times, and move over.
Man, I hope there's no newbies listening tonight. By the way,
there is a newbie listening today.
Oh.
I was teaching Lisa how to back up the trailer today.
Oh, no. With or without the mirrors.
And it's one of those little, it's just a short 6x10. So, you know, those can get kind of fun.
Right. What was she pulling it with?
An FJ Cruiser.
Oh, okay. So the tow vehicle was actually a little longer than the trailer.
Yeah, a little bit.
That makes backing difficult.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. She did good. I was surprised. So we'll have some more lessons tomorrow, but she's doing really well.
Well, you might have been surprised, but I'm not a bit surprised. I'm just saying that in case she was listening.
Yeah, I'm sure she's listening.
I am listening. I'm laughing. It was very ugly, Hugh.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear every now and then people calling about oil consumption and just you don't understand where the oil's going. And that's something I've always wondered about. I've driven pretty much Detroits for the last 14, 15 years, I guess. And I haven't noticed this so much with one that I have now, maybe not even the last one, but with previous trucks, I've noticed that, I keep having to add oil. But what happens is when I first change the oil or after I first add oil, that just in a matter of a few days, it seems to drop a half a gallon.
Okay.
And then it'll stabilize there.
Right.
And then I find that when I do, when it gets, about a gallon low, I add a gallon, and it pulls it back up to the full mark. But just in a couple of days, it's back down about a half gallon low. And
right.
This is my question. Does an engine just have a level that it wants to keep the oil and shouldn't run it over that level?
Yes.
Even if it's below the full mark on your dipstick? And I'm wondering,
yes.
Is that where a lot of people's fuel consumption is going? Is it just putting more oil in it than the engine wants?
I believe so. And, you know, I've known people, and I get calls once in a while, and they'll go, I'm using a lot of oil, and we'll try to figure out what's going on. And sometimes if I remember in my list of questions when I try to help somebody diagnose something, I'll remember to ask them, when do you add oil? Because for me, on a Class 8 diesel engine, I never add oil until I'm more than a gallon low. Well, some people get a little freaked out about that when it drops
right.
That half gallon, they put a half gallon back in. Well, then it used
to be a couple days.
Right. So the trick is let it drop that half gallon, and most of the time it'll stabilize right there for a much longer period of time. Then when you need a gallon, I mean, if you really wanted to try this, instead of adding a gallon when it gets a gallon low, maybe we should only add a half gallon.
Right. You may be able to run 5,000 miles longer and just add another half a gallon. Instead of using 2 gallons every 10,000 miles, you might wind up using a half a gallon in 10,000 miles just by letting it establish its own level.
Yeah, but I have definitely found that a lot of engines will do that, that they have their level somewhere in between full and add a gallon that they kind of stabilize at, and when you put in more than that, they tend to use it much quicker.
So should you just pay attention to that and try to establish where it prefers to run and just don't ever fill it past that point?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what I had done with some previous trucks, and it did seem to really reduce the oil consumption by running it at the level that it seemed to want to run. Because whatever it blows out that first 4 or 5 days, just don't ever replace that. Just let it run that at that level, you know, which in most cases that I've seen, about a half a gallon low.
Yeah, it would almost be, you know, we could almost remark the stick down to
right.
that new level, call that our top-off level, and we could still allow the truck to go a gallon low. Because even at
right.
that point, a gallon out of 11 is not hurting anything. So it's almost like you could reestablish your top mark and then wait for it to drop a full gallon, which technically might now become a gallon and a half from the original top mark, and just kind of readjust that range.
Another subject about ECMs. I don't know if you ever thought of this thread, but I don't think I could even direct you to it because I don't remember what the title of it was or what the original discussion was about, but it got into, you know, setting your revolutions per mile for your tires.
Yeah.
And the discussion was, does, you know, setting that number accurately, does it do anything more than making
no.
your speedometer and your odometer no. accurate?
No.
Okay. I was given to believe. Do what?
I was in that thread. And
oh, you were in there. Okay.
Yeah, and that thread got started because of a call I had on the air. And
uh-huh.
the caller claimed that the shop told him that his fuel mileage would be improved because that number was now accurate. And I tried to explain on the air that that's absolutely not true. What the reason your fuel mileage has improved on paper is because we're now tracking the accurate number of miles. But had
right.
we, you know, if we were on a dedicated run from New York to L.A., and we had been using X number of gallons to make that run back and forth all the time, and it's pretty consistent. And then we went in and changed, and we were tracking our fuel mileage on paper. We would have this number. Let's say it's 7 miles to the gallon. And we go in and we change the RPM of the tire in the computer. Now we track our fuel mileage, and all of a sudden we're getting 7.3. Did our fuel mileage get
better? Using the same amount of fuel.
That's what we would have to go back and look at. And I can promise you that you are using the exact same amount of fuel to run that trip. We're now accurately recording the miles on that trip. That's why the number have changed.
And
that number has nothing to do with the performance or any other parameters in the engine.
Now I had suggested that possibly there was more to it than that. The ECM being a computer and using data to make the engine run at peak efficiency and performance. And that
right.
if it did not have the right numbers going in, that it may not produce the right engine settings to get peak performance. And that's not one of the numbers that the computer uses to do that. Because I figure if you tell the ECM you're doing 40 miles an hour, but you're actually doing 50 miles an hour, I would think that it would be sending the wrong messages as far as injection timing and such as that.
Now, speed and RPM don't figure into it. It does take into account, temperatures, boost pressures, other parameters that could throw it off, but speed and RPM are not any of the factors. But good thinking. I mean, that's those are the kind of things we need to think about. I better get to some calls here before I run out of time. Let's go to Indiana. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. Hey, I'm the guy that talked to you at Matt. I've been dying to say that ever since I talked to you up there.
Okay.
One of the 10 million. I have a report and then also a question. I run a Volvo, and I did speak to you for at length. I'm one of the guys that's been experimenting with plugging off the EGR valve on this thing.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And since that time, I've logged about 60,000 miles since I plugged it, but I've gone on to some other things after that point. But I ran a solid 35,000-mile test with that change only, and I saw a definite 4/10 improvement on this Volvo. And
wow.
I run light, and I'm already at the top end of the mileage scale. So I'm thinking that some of these guys that are running heavy all the time may even see more than that. I'm now pushing 60,000 since I've done it and still have zero problems whatsoever. No D-rate, no check engine codes, nothing. It's been a total positive thing for me. So just wanted to make that. Then a quick plug before I get to the real question. And I did several things all at once. They just all were needed. And so rather than doing one piece at a time, but I put low rolling resistance gears, a Pittsburgh power muffler, and the one thing that I did do, I didn't have to do, was I installed the air tags on this, and I have gained a total now of another 4/10 with the addition of those three things. And so very, very good. The air tabs are marvelous. I just ran across southern Minnesota and Nebraska on Monday with 30 to 35 mile an hour direct crosswind. I had no idea that I had any kind of wind like that. They are fantastic. So
yeah,
really good product, very satisfied.
Excellent. Glad to hear.
Now here's, just really happy. My question is, I'm in the process of buying another truck, put another driver on, and we've got him already leased on to another company in a wretched lease purchase one, so I'm trying to get him out of. And I'm looking at vehicles on the low end of the price range, just trying to get him in it. He's going to buy it off of me, he's going to pay me for it, so I don't want my investment to be real huge.
Right.
I'm looking at a 2000 Freightliner, the Century, with the Detroit 12.7. I said 2000, I'm sorry, it's an 03, but it's a 3 EGR.
Okay.
840,000 miles. Did a dyno on it, 94% horsepower, really good. Fred, I pulled an oil sample. It looks good. Nothing out of the ordinary except for the nitrates are a little high. But here's my question. On the dyno run, it's blowing 5.1 on the blow-by.
Okay.
Everything, the specs are great, 358, some bed roof. Like I said, the other things are coming back good. The truck works in every way. I'm just a little concerned about that blow-by.
What's the price?
$11,500.
Okay. I wouldn't be concerned. That blow-by isn't bad, and your nitration is an indication of that blow-by as well. So those two
right,
things,
and I was aware of that, and that was my question because my Volvo, I bought it new. This will only be the second Class 8 that I've ever bought. I'm just not familiar with the blow-by aspect of it, and they did flag it at the Freightliner dealers as well. Blow-by is a little high. And but the rest of the truck just—it looks great. I'm just looking for a big flag here that's I'm trying to find something that's don't buy this truck. And I know you talk so many times at 11.5, and how can you go wrong? Well, I understand that, but at the same time, I don't want an 11.5 truck to become a $20,000 truck. I'm wanting to buy an $11,000 truck.
Okay, here's the way I would budget for this: that the slightly high blow by, and I don't really consider this high for that mileage, maybe a tad, but nothing that makes me get too worried about it. For this kind of mileage, we expect the blow-by to be a little bit higher. That's what's causing the nitration, so it's consistent. I would still say that you've got a truck that is good to at least 1 million miles before needing an in-frame, And that's kind of what we're looking for when we look at the blow-by. So to me, it's an $11,000 truck that needs to budget for an in-frame, figure 15 more thousand for the in-frame, within the next 2 years is what I would be budgeting for. And that wouldn't scare me away from this truck at all. In fact, I'm in the market for about that same truck, and I would consider that one. Although, if you're looking at an 03 mid-roof Freightliner and you're willing to, you know, you're in that price range, look for the maroon Maverick trucks. They're even better specs. Or the orange full 70-inch condo Schneider trucks with the 264s in the direct drives. That's the truck I'm currently shopping for right now. Let's go to Colorado this time. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. Hey, I got. I'm running a 2003 Three Bridge 850 in a W900L. I know you hate that, but I've done a lot to this truck as far as slowing myself down, and trying to believe in your philosophies and they work. So, you know, I've got a big motor I used to build, a fuel train up in Wyoming and whatnot. So we've gotten away from the 115,000 pounds, and now we're down, you know, 80,000 and less, one trailer, that kind of thing. Now, I've been suckered in on some snake oil stuff before, and I'm just wanting to get your thoughts. This truck, I put the tires back on it that were on it when the truck was manufactured, which was a Fire 22.5.
Okay.
The motor is a 355, and a 18.913 has me at 1600 at 70, and now I've got I'm at 1500 at 70, and I'm getting 6 miles to the gallon. Right at 6.01 miles to the gallon, all the time, every time. So, and I can't get numbers off the internet for some reason, but, you know, everybody's talking about these air pads for stability, but not necessarily for fuel savings. Is that kind of the gist of it, Kevin?
Yeah, you know, it is. Here's the thing. Everybody loves the product. Stability, spray, all those things, you notice an immediate difference. Now, logically, we also know that if we've got an aerodynamic problem between the tractor and the trailer, and if we can make that problem better, we should see improved fuel mileage. There's some testing on it. It does show fuel mileage increases. I haven't done enough of my own testing with it. When I put them on, I was doing two or three other things at the same time. My mileage did go up, but I don't know what I can contribute to what. So it is one of those things that like the earlier caller, I like that order. We look at the product for stability, spray, and then the fuel mileage benefits. And when you look at those three things, if they only picked up 1/10 of a mile per gallon, which we wouldn't be able to measure, it still makes the product, it puts it in that category of what I consider to be a no-brainer.
So what about going like with an air cell? Do you have any comments on that? On this cat, they say that it helps that air come out of that charger cooler a little bit better and condenses that air a little bit more. I mean, is that a viable option?
All right, here's my take on this. Again, remember how I look at products. First, I look at logic and physics. Then I look at testing. If it looks like it makes sense to me, on a turbocharged engine and a turbocharged diesel engine that already has a combustion chamber that's designed to bring air in a certain direction in a certain pattern, putting something in the middle of that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So logically and looking at physics, the product doesn't make sense to me, so I haven't been – it's not on my short list of products to test because I don't see it logically in using physics. I have found some people who report back some gains, some people don't. So I don't have the testing, and I'm not in a big hurry to put it on my list because I just don't see the light. We're all out of time. Thanks for joining me tonight. Remember, be safe, be profitable, be responsible, and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Good night, everyone. 30 minutes, live shows coming up on SiriusXM. Join me, please. Good night.